Hey guys, how you doing? I am Ron Newcomb, the Indie Coach, and just a quick little recap on why we're doing these podcasts. You know, Dave, I had the question of why do the best athletes in the world need to hire personal coaches? I mean, by the definition, they're already the best, so why would they need a coach? And it really is because a coach can give us a different perspective that we cannot get on our own. So even the best athletes out in the world, I think of a lot of soccer players and the like, they still hire personal coaches so that they can incrementally grow. And a coach is a way to do that. At least in my own life, I can look back through all the sports that I played. I've had significant incremental growth when a coach has poured into my life over a short period of time. And that's what's funny. It's kind of in and out. You know, it's only for the season of football or baseball, whatever it was. But during those times, I've had incremental growth in that area. And so I feel like we can do the same thing with having these conversations in a podcast format to learn from one another and to grow in our creative pursuits. So that's kind of the thrust of this whole thing and why we're doing an Indie Coach. And although I see through a filmmaking lens, I took off the indie film coach part. I took the word film out of there because I really felt like I was a storyteller, not just a filmmaker, and a creative and an artist, not just a filmmaker. And it's broadened up. Like I've now done comic books and board games and a card game, and I've done much more other things that I'm still interested in beyond just the filmmaking part. I think you and I share that in common. So obviously, I know you as Dave, but many people know you as Mini Wargaming Dave. Can you tell me a little bit of, and our listeners, a little just quick history of how you got started with Mini Wargaming, and then also maybe go into because that is unique in and of itself, but then how it got turned into an actual business.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. So 16 years ago it was that I jumped into YouTube, and it was a brand new landscape. YouTube was only about a year old as a platform and didn't really know what to expect at that point. I had an online store with my business partner, Matthew Glanfield, and we started Mini Wargaming together. And we sold miniatures. We sold tabletop miniature figurines, plastic miniatures, metal miniatures to play board games, basically, right? And so every video we made went back to the store, marketed the store. And there was a time that we had to change our trade policy to basically accommodate for the manufacturer that we were selling. And we had to shut the online store down because of that. We weren't allowed to actually sell online anymore. So we focused solely on content at that point. And we started our paid subscription, where people would pay for a monthly subscription to get more content. And this is before Patreon was a thing. This before YouTube memberships was a thing. So Matt's background, he's an internet marketer, and my background, I was a landscaper who just jumped into an online world, right? So kind of a bit of a artistic mind, you could say. So I did more of a like tutorials and that sort of thing, and it kind of just started there. We grew an audience. We got more members of the team on board creating content with us. And fast forward to today, and we've been making videos in the tabletop wargaming community industry for that time. We have close to 15,000 videos that we've made, combination of YouTube and our paid subscription. We celebrated our 200 millionth view on YouTube just a number of months ago. So it's crazy to, because it's been a slow process for us, right? It's been 16 years. And so for us, that's it feels right when we look at it today. But when we kind of zoom out and do a macro view of the whole thing, it's like, man, it's been an incredible journey. And the community that's been cultivated because of it is really far reaching. And we live in our own bubble because we live in a pretty small town. It's about maybe 60,000 people, maybe a little more. And then there's the online aspect of it, right? But the in-person, we get a taste of that when we go to conventions. We go to tabletop gaming conventions, and there's a very potent crowd saying that they've been watching the videos for years, and it's gotten them into games, and it's gotten them through, heck, it's even gotten them through dark times in their lives and helped them kind of escape into a hobby, into a game. And so it's much, much bigger than we can possibly imagine or understand, I think, which is kind of the biggest benefit and biggest takeaway for me anyway, is that it's not just a matter of doing the work. It's a matter of the effects of the work. And that's now become the purpose of the work, is to just perpetuate that kind of good feeling, that good positive impact on people, on humanity, because we could be doing anything, right? Anything, we could choose to do anything. And we stumbled upon this thing, and the thing that it is good. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's become so. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm sure you guys didn't set off necessarily. Well, maybe you did. You set off with the idea of potentially creating a business, but initially it was miniatures that you would sell and not necessarily do the content. And then suddenly forced by de facto that you were no longer allowed to sell the minis, that you had to go into kind of go all in with content creation. And with Matt's background, it was like, hey, I think we can actually do this. And with our analytics, I think we can drive in that direction. And so suddenly you go full steam ahead. And like you said, you had the advantage of looking back now and saying, yeah, that worked. But at the time, I'm sure that was scary as all get out.
It was scary.
And unknown. And like you said, not many people out there doing it, much less in an extremely niche environment. And you probably didn't know how deep the water was amongst the mini community. Like certainly sales and stuff, I'm sure, have been good for the big brands, but a niche video content creator, how deep can that well go? I'm sure that was a little nerve-wracking too, and not really knowing that it could sustain quite a bit. You guys have been able to do a lot. As a content creator and entertainer, it seems to me like the lines have blurred quite a bit. You've spoke to this a little bit, but how do you see the industry evolving at this moment in time? And you can even maybe think of kind of macro level, micro level. I mean, certainly the talk of the town amongst filmmakers is AI and the legitimacy of all that and the fear and all that stuff. But kind of since you've been, you know, on, you already talked about a couple of things, like now there's Patreon and YouTube ways to connect and take back your favorite creator, but you guys didn't have that. And now that's evolved and changed. What are some of the things as a content creator and entertainer in that space that you've kind of seen grow?
So I think one of the biggest things is the style by which content is consumed now has evolved drastically from where it was over a decade ago. So over a decade ago, you could be a vlogger and you could make a 10-minute video, one shot the entire time talking, and it would be interesting enough that you could generate an audience and cultivate a following and develop community. Whereas if you were to try something like that now, the viewer attention span has been shortened such that it won't penetrate that attention economy that now exists. You have to keep up with traffic, essentially, right? So the speed limit has increased. And it's like short bursts. Now it hasn't got to the point where it's so bad that it's impossible. It's just, it's much faster than what it was. And it is a lot more sophisticated in terms of what's required to grab attention, to be a storyteller, and to put more effort into it, because everyone's a storyteller and many people, in one degree or another, everyone's a storyteller, right? And community and viewers, they ultimately, as humans, we want to engage in people and we want to go on a journey of a story. So if we're just talking free-flowing consciousness and it's kind of all over the place, I mean, there's a market for that, but there isn't you're not going to get the widest possible market within your space. If you approach it that way, you got to be really conscientious of what kind of stories are being told in the space. What is the way in which people prefer to be told stories? And you got to really develop a good tool set for that. And like, for instance, the first 30 seconds of a YouTube video is disputably the most important 30 seconds. Heck, the first 5 to 10 seconds actually is it. And also a thumbnail used to just be, you know, you grab one of the random frames from the video And then it was, okay, no, you got to be a little bit more deliberate to accurately represent the video. And now it's, you have to set proper expectation for it, whilst also be kind of loud and clickbaity, but not false clickbaity, where you're not getting what you're watching when you watch the video, but it's spectacle enough that you need to be loud in a sea of content creators, not just in your space, but in the space of content creation, which there's so much more of now. And it's really, that actually trails over to the first 5 seconds of the video. Because when you scroll over with your mouse, or heck, when you're scrolling on your thumb and your phone, the video does play with no music or with no audio in like the first 5 seconds plays, right? So that thumbnail frame bleeds into the first 5 seconds. So you got to make sure that you're changing all those things. Like, we weren't thinking about this stuff over a decade ago, right? Yeah. And so the things that we're thinking of now has evolved. And interesting, you should bring up AI, because this is it's affecting every industry, really. And specifically how it affects content creation is misinformation and a saturation. And so it's so easy for really anyone to just curate content, and heck, even just amalgamize content with voices that are made from scripts that can be made in lightning speed. And so when a whole bunch of that is being infused into the viewership economy, and that's mixed in with people who are putting a lot of time into the creation of their content, but they may not be doing it in a way that grabs attention as efficiently as those AI videos. It's, you have this disparity of, here's a lot of content that, yes, may get a lot of clicks, but it's kind of lacking substance and lacking soul. Mm-hmm. And at first I was quite concerned about that. And to be fair, there is still a concern, but now there's concern kind of tethered with some optimism, and that optimism comes from the acknowledgement of there's always going to be a subset of viewership that prefers content created by people.
Yeah.
And it's like a friend of mine recently gave me this example, which kind of helped settle my mind on it. And they said, well, you can have a factory that makes loaves of bread and makes it perfectly, or you can have the artisan bread where there's a baker kneading the dough, spending time on it. It is more expensive, but it tastes better. And you can feel the art that goes in. You appreciate it a lot more. And so there's always going to be a percentage of people that really engage in that. And that actually drives up the value of that content so much more. And I think that stands the test of time. Like, art is thousands of years old. It stands the test of time. And why does it, right? There's this, I think there's unspoken thing within all of us that we recognize that. We recognize the energy that goes into that.
Yeah.
As opposed to something just being mass produced for the purpose of getting views and making money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's a great way to put it. I totally agree with you. I love the illustration. I'm a visual learner. So having that, you're kind of thinking of the bread factory versus the actual baker there, putting in a sense of artistry into the bread is a good analogy. If you were starting today, where would you start now? Like, for instance, what social media platform would you lean into in today's time frame? Would it still be YouTube, or is there other things out there that you find interesting?
It depends what my focus was. Is my focus to monetize? Yeah, it would be.
Yeah, let's start there.
Okay. So what I would do is I would start with YouTube, because out of all of the platforms that exist, all the social media platforms, of which I use all of them to spread influence, and the one that has consistently been the most monetizable by far, by a landslide, is YouTube. Mm. And I think it's because YouTube's platform, it caters very well to creators who wish to develop a brand and a following. Whereas some of the other social media platforms cater more to the platform itself. And they, especially with the short form content, So they don't necessarily promote creators. They just promote viral type videos. And so sure, videos might get millions of views and clicks and comments, but there's not that parasocial relationship that is developed over time. It doesn't happen in the same way with the other platforms as it happens on YouTube, because YouTube is longer form content where you can really engage in certain things and you get to know the creators really well. There's a number of brands and creators you can list on YouTube, but say for instance, TikTok, it's much more difficult to name creators unless they're already a known creator on another platform such as YouTube, right? So I would definitely recommend YouTube for that. And they have, and there's a lot of talk of, well, you know, YouTube is just getting saturated and there's just so many more people trying to make videos. And that is a fact, but it is also a fact that YouTube is growing and that more and more people are actually discovering it every day. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing for creators. Yeah, it's evolving, but it caters to that. So I would recommend YouTube. And there's a lot of that. There's a good amount of granularity there as well. Such as like, if you want to monetize your videos, make videos that are 10 to 15 minutes long, right? Because that the audience or the algorithm favors videos that are a little longer because it places more ads in it. So ultimately YouTube wants to make money off of the advertisers and wants to place the ads on videos that will get views. And those videos that are story driven, that cultivate audience, that make videos that viewers can trust, that they will get good quality when they watch it. It makes YouTube more money, and it makes the creator more money as well. So it's cyclical, it's symbiotic in nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would do that. That's certainly what I would do and suggest. And no matter the market, actually. So no matter what you do, that's a good macro general advice that seems to be, the best answer in that case.
Yeah.
YouTube.
Yeah, no, I mean, with it being like, I think it's the number two search engine, you know, people don't think of it that way, but you know, we do, we go on and, you know, what do? I'm like Googling that. Google, I think, owns YouTube. And so the YouTube videos come up as well. And yeah, I'm clicking on a how-to video, and next thing you know, I'm, you know, able to fix something. What is your process for developing ideas for content or for shoots, or perhaps your inspiration beyond just the, you know, the models or the minis? And then kind of a follow-up to this, what I know you and I have talked a lot about story. I mean, I think one night we spent like 2 hours just talking about story, which was awesome. I love our deep conversations. But
absolutely,
yeah. What draws people into story? That's kind of a secondary. So what's the process for developing your shoots, your ideas, your inspiration for those? And then what draws people into story?
So the process. So first off, to lay some context, the content that's created on Mini Wargaming's YouTube channel specifically, there's a few different types. Like one is video battle reports, and we are recording ourselves play a game, and it's 1 to 2 hours long typically that the video ends up being. And from an audience perspective, you're basically a fly on the wall, and you get to kind of be right next to us as we're rolling dice and having fun and capturing those moments. And then the other type of content that's created, which is something that I'm more personally involved in, because we have a team of people that make videos. And so the personal projects are more story driven in nature, because they're shorter videos. They're typically 10 to 20 minutes long, and they do take more time. They take longer than a day to a day and a half to produce, which is what the video battle reports take. The story-driven ones take, I want to say, sometimes they take a month. Mm-hmm. It could take a month. Sometimes it's a week, and sometimes it's 3 months. So the bottleneck there is writing the script. For me personally, that's a bottleneck, because I'm the kind of brain where I'm 50 ideas a minute. Like, it's just going, like, it's for sure. It's ADHD for me. And it's all over the place. And so I'm lucky that I have people around me that help me focus, and have a great team to work with. And I used to want to make a video that was really engaging, that got a lot of views that people would like. And that was the driving force behind making a video that would be considered good and evergreen that you can go back to and rewatch. But that's evolved for me to making a video that I would want to make, that I like, that I feel passionate about. And it's almost in reverse. It's almost like, it's not quite to heck with the audience, because that's not accurate, because I care very much about the audience, but it's more so, why am I making this?
Yeah.
What's driving me to make this? And how am I using my voice to express the story that I want to share right now? And what does it mean to me? Because I find that that trumps any sort of, I'm going to make this video because it's going to get caught in the algorithm and it's going to grab this attention and it's going to get all these views. That's a very technical approach, which isn't a good or bad thing. It's just a preference. So that the preference for me has evolved into, no matter how many views this video gets, is secondary to what is the story that I'm trying to tell.
Yeah.
And how do I feel about it? And why? Why am I telling it? If this was the very last video that I would ever work on, how would I make this video?
Yeah.
And that has really helped me to tell stories that I feel proud to tell. And it almost has this reverse effect, where before it was like, okay, I'm going to make videos that get a lot of views. And I don't remember the comments. I don't remember the impact of those. But the ones that I personally care about, when people say, that meant a lot, that's what I remember. And I think that's truly evergreen, where it's like milestones almost. It's like you get to look back at your collection, so to speak, of videos, and you can be, these are basically journal or diary entries of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to fast forward into the other part of that, which you were asking about, what was the second part of
story? What draws people into story?
I think it's one of those time-old ways that just humans communicate with each other. There's a beginning, middle, end. There's conflict. There's a resolution of that conflict. There's a meeting of expectation or a betrayal of expectation at the end, or a surprise at the end. There's something that you're left. You're moved. You're literally, it moves you, your brain. It moves your thoughts. You remember, it leaves an impression. And I think the story format is just one of those things that we have evolved to just consume really any sort of information.
Yeah.
Whether it's a video or a movie or even just a story that you're telling a friend, it's a nice package.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not, here's an hour long of information. It's no, here's a, this is my goal and this is how I'm going to get there. But this is my first stumbling block and I tripped along the way and there's a bear along the path and I got to get around the bear. And to get around the bear first, I got to climb the tree. And when I climb the tree, I see the castle in the distance, but the storm clouds are coming in. And so now I got to seek shelter for the night. And so it's, you go through this journey, right? And you can, and I think really as well, the reason why story works so well is that it makes it relatable.
Mm-hmm.
And as a creator, as an influencer, as a person telling stories, relatability is key. Because if you're not relatable, then there's no, as you said before, right? They're visual learners. There's analogies that are drawn. You gotta connect with the audience. Otherwise we're lost. We're lost in the sea of noise. So yeah.
Yeah. My dad would always tell me growing up, he would say, if you want to reach the heart, you have to speak from the heart. And, you know, I know you to be a very passionate guy. And I think that's a lot of things people I'm sure have poured into your life and with appreciation of your openness, your willingness to go there and to show that emotional side of humanity. And people respect that. People want that. They want to be moved, not only like in a literal sense sometimes, but they want to be moved to some type of emotional journey. They want that escapism, you know, even if it's talking about minis and things. It's an affinity, a passionate hobby that that people take seriously because it's a lot of fun. You put a lot of time and resources and effort into it. And you want it to kind of matter. So to me, stories, it's that simplicity that my dad said, you want to speak to the heart, you speak from the heart. And to me, that's something, that story element, and it has those elements, like you said, beginning, middle, and all those things. You're moving somebody on a journey. But when I do a video, those are the things I'm thinking about, is trying to allow myself to go there, because there is that relatability. And a lot of times, you know, I'll speak, you know, from a guy's lens, we don't want to go there necessarily, but deep down we so do, you know, we so do hope that someone carries us to an emotional place. But there's, for whatever reason, some resistance to it on the surface of it. And we've gotten a lot better over time, but certainly that's something that I think of when I think of story. At the end of a film, I want somebody to be moved emotionally and what I've kind of created for them. If you have someone that is, you know, just kind of starting out, whatever videos that they might be creating, some content, how would one, in your mind now, work on creating a fan base? Any advice or thoughts or ideas on kind of banging the drum of fan base development?
And again, the idea is to monetize. Is it just for fun?
It's the right question. You know, because there's an entrepreneurial slant to, you know, my thinking, at least, let's mm-hmm. take it from like a monetization point of view, but not solely to monetize. Like, it's not a business that's going to put down an AI thing. And yeah, you know, it's however many views we can get in X minute mm-hmm. to try to turn a dollar. It's more of, I want to turn this passion that I have into a paid monetizable element. And therefore, mm-hmm. I'm trying to develop a fan base in order to do that.
Okay. So what I would say about to that is, and I'm glad you mentioned, if you have like a passion that you want to, or a hobby or something like that, that you want to share, I think that coming from that point of view, there's a lot of knowledge that's acquired that's kind of effortlessly acquired. It's like your default idle thoughts go to that thing that you love and are passionate about anyway. You can't wait to get home from work and get a free spare moment to think about it and to work on it and to do mm-hmm. things for it. So I think making a, you know, developing a following with that as its core is a very good first foundational block to a channel, because then it's driven by, I'm going to look at things that I'm curious about, that I want to look at, that I want to learn about. I'm going to be talking to people within my space that I want to talk to, that I'm looking forward to meeting. And so it's driven by that, because money follows a good idea. So, and it ebbs and flows with cash flow. So you start there, and then you just share of yourself. Mm-hmm. You share your perspective because you fit within a community of people, and you share your perspective. And I would say also exercise a bit of, don't be afraid to be vulnerable, mm-hmm. because vulnerability is relatability, mm-hmm. because everyone has vulnerabilities. And that is the relatable thing, right? Going up there as the absolute expert, and you are absolutely perfect in your field. And it's different if that's your thing, right? If that's like, I've been doing this for forever, and I have knowledge that I want to share, like, that's different. If this is my passion, this is my hobby, and this is just along the way, don't be afraid to show mistakes, right? Don't be afraid to show that as part of the journey of whatever it is, because people make mistakes. Yeah. And so I relate that to miniature painting. Painting miniatures is a hobby, is a passion, and many people learn miniature painting, but the very first barrier to entry is, I don't know how to do that. I don't want to make mistakes. Heck, I don't want to make mistakes. I don't want to show the world that I'm making mistakes, because I open myself up to scrutiny, and that's painful. So why would I do that?
Yeah.
The irony behind that is, by showing that vulnerability, you open yourself up and you open up the audience to a conversation and engagement. It's like, yes, I made that mistake too. Mm-hmm. Thanks for showing, and thanks for showing how you overcame that mistake and how you learned from it, because that's a lot more interesting. Those are the hurdles along the way in the story, as opposed to, here's a perfectly precise story. that you know what to expect. Right. It's different if you're making educational videos. Actually, no, you know what? No, I'll take that back. You can still apply that concept to educational videos to make them more entertaining.
Absolutely. Right? I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the best teachers I've had, you know, are the passionate ones that let themselves go a little bit, go off book and are vulnerable. They show them themselves and their true passion from within. How about, you know, in film, star power is still a thing. As the world, as you said, more content creation is just being created. Is there a thing now? Well, there certainly is star power, if you will. Does that matter in a YouTube world?
The concepts, I would say that the concepts are transferable. So meaning like if you're starting in a, let's say you're starting as a filmmaker, right? And you're starting in that space and you're making short films. The reaching out and doing collaborations with other short filmmakers on YouTube and cross-pollinating audiences is mutually beneficial.
Yeah.
Because you grab from each other's, and it's a good practice to reach out to other creators who are similar in size to you and a bit bigger than you. And as you develop more of a following, that the same concept applies, where you can, you know, reach out to others and reach out to more, and also reach out to, I would say on occasion, reach out to those who have less as well. Kind of go, don't be afraid to go all over. Cause if it's only ever reaching up, then it's just like you were once there starting out.
Yeah, exactly. And you're only self-serving, and people kind of have a tendency to feel that they can, you know, get, and your person now who's small, you know, somebody's going to be the next big thing and blow up. And you might have been the one to kind of help establish that. And frankly, it's the right thing to do. You know,
it's just good
practice. It makes you feel good. It rubs off on you because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. It's a good will thing too. And whether you have one follower or a million, there's things to be learned.
Yeah.
And you know, you can, and you just never know that the person who has one follower is just skyrockets.
Yeah.
And is bringing you up then the next time you reach out and do something, right? So it's all the same.
Yeah.
It's all the same. But a balance, I think, is important, right? A balance of reaching out to others who are like-minded.
Yeah.
Bigger or smaller or the same. Yeah. That's what I would recommend.
Like, run as fast as you can and then look to your left and to your right. And those are your peers. You know, those are the people that are in about your same level. That's who you should be reaching out to. That's the world that you're kind of in right now. And then, yeah, strive to reach up. And it's a poignant point to say, hey, don't forget the other people kind of behind too, that they matter. You mentioned co-productions. I seem to be kind of seeing, I don't know about more, but certainly co-productions and co-op type of things are pretty prevalent. Do people, well, I know that people have brought you in on different projects. Do you see more co-productions kind of happening today? And if someone had like a perfect Mini Wargaming Dave thing, do people reach out to you?
Yes. Okay. So the answer is yes, I'm seeing more. Now that could be because I'm doing a lot more of them, and there's a Dunning-Kruger effect there where it's like, oh, I guess people are doing them more. Maybe they could have always been happening, but I'm just, I'm noticing it more.
Yeah,
I'm just noticing it more. And yes, that people, I reach out to people, people reach out to me, and it's this, you know, it's a two-way street. So it's, and that just becomes part of the practice of content creation. One of the considerations for me is when I'm making, when I'm engaging in a project is, who could I collaborate with? Does this warrant collaboration? And in most cases, it's yes, right? It's like, yeah, who could I bring on board that would find this fun, rewarding, that would make sense for audiences, that, you know, they would be excited to see both the creators kind of mix and do a project together. And it is an ecosystem. It truly is an ecosystem of content creation with creators in a similar space where on this side of the pond, I got these plants, and on your side, you got those cactails. And so if we cross-pollinate, then it's just a more, there's more growth on both sides now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just so much good. It's so much better.
Yeah, like I love the guy. I'm trying to sit and remember his name. I'm sure your fans are going to kill me for it, but the guy, the fitness guy,
Stephen Box.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, Vanguard Tactics. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. He seems to be a really great guy, fun guy, great shape. You know, so there's that. So I know we kind of share that passion as well. There's that fitness element to it. And yet he's in a different place, you know, geographically even. And I've seen you guys been collaborating quite a bit. So that seems like a perfect fit and match there.
Yeah. Yeah. And here's the cool thing about that too, is there's so many discoveries, because like a community of content is comprised of thousands of sub communities of content.
Yeah.
And so let's say the tabletop gaming space, let's use that for instance, right? That doesn't just include Warhammer and board games. It also includes Dungeons and Dragons, includes Magic the Gathering. Like, it's the tabletop, anything you play, any game you play on the tabletop, heck, you play Monopoly, right? That there's so many people. And so then from that larger community, then you zoom into the tabletop miniature wargaming community, which is a smaller subset of the larger. And then within that one, you can branch out to lore videos, painting hobby videos, gameplay videos within that space. And then you zoom into each one of those, then it's, all right, here's story-driven talking head videos of me doing a tutorial. Mm-hmm. And here's a music video version of me doing a tutorial. And so it's like, there's so many.
Yeah.
And the cool thing is, like, for instance, what you brought up there about that is there's fitness.
Yeah.
Gaming, right? Yeah. So it's like, huh, this is cool. Let's integrate this to kind of infuse a different branch into the overall, like I said, ecosystem of content.
Yeah.
Just to help mix it all together, to like normalize it, to show it as a thing,
and
to grow in different ways.
You know, fitness and gamers usually were not said in the same sentence, you know?
Right.
And
yeah.
So to bring those two worlds together, it's not like if you're a gamer, you know, you shouldn't be healthy. We all know that. But finding the time and the like-mindedness, usually those people didn't traverse in the same worlds. So to cross stream those and say, no, here we are as gamers, and yet we're going to maintain a fitness level. And there was something cool and unique about that, that felt like, yeah, this is a nice marriage, you know, bringing these two worlds together.
Yeah.
In your typical day, what does a typical day for more Wargaming Mini Dave kind of look like, in your kind of 9-to-5 typical day?
So for myself, each day is different. I thrive in a non-structured format. And so when it's structured, that only lasts so long. And that's taken years to evolve there, because that's a privilege to be able to do that. Because many are stuck in structures that don't want to be. And so I was for many years, over a decade, there was a structure and I burnt out from that structure, and I had to evolve out of it, find ways to still accomplish what I want to and grow in different ways. And I fought for it. And then now it is here. So it's, each day is different, but I would say some similarities between the days are, I am posting on social media. And there's a bit of time there that I want to say there's between 1 and 3 hours a day, depending on the day, where I'm writing posts, and I'm finding pictures. I'm taking pictures. Sometimes I curate pictures and I tag other people. Sometimes I take my own. And sometimes I make compilations of pictures. Sometimes I make reels. Sometimes it's tagged to products that other people make. Sometimes it's tagged to my own products that I make. And so it's always a little different. And there's ongoing projects at any given moment. For instance, right now there's about 10 or 11 projects that I'm engaged in. Some are longer. Some will take 2 years to complete. Some are about 3 months. Some are next week, right? Some are today. I'm going to get this done today. And so they're all running in tandem with each other. Some are just, I do on my own, right? I can write a post on my own, making a video with someone who's a guest that comes into the studio, right? That's a collaborative. And so that could be a few day project. And so it is different day to day. But the commonality is it's creative. So I am engaging in creative energy, and I get energy from people, being an extrovert, any sort of You want to have an idea session? We want to play the game of idea bouncing back and forth. I love playing that game, right? That infuses me. That inspires me. And so some of my day is dedicated to phone calls where that's all it is. It's a business meeting in a sense where we're going to come up with something or continue ironing out details of a current project, and it's energizing. So that helps to keep me going. And whilst I'm on the phone, I'm literally moving. So I'm walking around, I'm doing squats and curls because when I'm doing this stuff, I work from home, because by doing that, I'm generating even more dopamine throughout the day that kind of infuses into the conversations, which spills over into the projects that I'm working on. And so it's all this kind of mishmash of a bunch of different things. And then sometimes I travel to go to different countries, to different cities, collaborate with other creators. And I go to conventions as well to promote stuff that we're working on. We're making a tabletop miniature war game right now called Ravaged Star. And so there's a lot of work behind that. That was started a couple of years ago. And that's something that plans on staying indefinitely. So that's a big endeavor, has a lot of moving parts. It's a train that moves slowly, but it's a train that moves. And once the train is moving, which it is right now, you try stopping a train, right? Yeah. It just keeps on going, laying more tracks. And so, I don't know if that answers a typical day. It's like, kind of.
Yeah, no, definitely. No, I appreciate that. Yeah. And giving some real world examples. Again, I think some people get caught up in the structure of things that they get stifled in it and they are not creative. I also love lately you've been, like you said, you've semi-recently lost a good bit of weight, and you did that by incorporating and infusing your passion and love for fitness and that nature into, hey, while I'm literally doing this, I'm going to walk around and do some squats, or you'll drop down quickly. And I even asked you like, hey man, what are you kind of doing? And you got back to me quickly. And, it's like, hey, I might just drop and do pushups, just like on a whim, and just knock out pushups. And you've been posting those videos like, hey, I'm going to knock out eight sets of eight, because somebody loves the number eight. So you've been incorporating that. I've loved seeing that. So I think people can really take to heart, particularly when you're not able to do it full time. I think a lot of the people that listen to this, they're enthusiasts that are trying to, I wouldn't say hobbyist, they are definitely enthusiasts that are trying to move the ball from where they're currently at to full-time vocational in the area of which they're passionate about and they feel called to, even, much like myself. If a film fights you every step of the way, what are the hurdles that you've had to overcome while producing, while being a content creator?
That is a very, very wonderful, terrifying question, Ron. I appreciate the question. I guess for the context of the Rangers, I'll use that as the example. So based on your movie, thank you for taking a chance on me like a decade ago that you invited me to be a part of your film. That planted a seed of the love of filmmaking at the time, which was a dream of mine since I was a kid. And so first time film experience doing that, it just exploded this world of possibility. And okay, so fast forwarding to the time where I'm making my own film after getting permission from you to use some of the characters from the Rangers, my own character in it. The film fighting you every step of the way. And I remember you telling me that back then too. And, so I was very naive at the time. And like, I don't doubt it'd be difficult, but we could do it. It's how I've made a lot of YouTube videos, at that point it was a couple thousand YouTube videos that I'd made. Right. And so it's like, dude, like it's all good. It's just a short film. It's not even as long as, and so like all this super, super cocky, thinking that I could do it easily. And it's not to say that it's impossible, but it definitely does fight you in ways in which you don't expect.
Yeah.
Because as you know better than most, it is just this ball of problems that unfold along the way.
Yep.
And it's micro decisions, thousands of micro decisions along the way. And it's so much fatigue. And sometimes you get so stuck in the tar of that, that it's like, why am I even doing this?
Yeah.
What, why is it even worth it?
Yeah.
And so how, I think the, again, zooming out, looking at it macro, the thing that I, my biggest takeaway from the film that I ended up producing and making, which I wrote, I starred in, I directed, produced, I completely egoed all over that, Ron. That was, I need to do everything. I need to edit this. I got to make sure I look at every shot when it's made. And the biggest takeaway for me was I don't need to do everything myself.
Yeah.
Right. And I had to go through it to really learn that, because to be told something without any sort of context or experience, it's very hard sell, right? You got to walk through hell to want to go to heaven. You gotta like go through the pain of that. And it's at the end of that process, which that movie almost didn't get made. Almost, yeah. Like, and that was, there was a lot of public accountability there because I did a Kickstarter for it, right? There was a good $50,000 on the line with a few thousand people expecting a product, expecting a film.
Yep.
Very altruistic fans supporting the vision and idea. So there's that added weight on top of it.
Yeah.
It's like, that was a massive weight that I didn't know I was running into. And it just, I'd say the biggest takeaway is I needed to overcome myself. I was in my own way. I was the biggest stumbling block in my own way. And it was when I said to Aaron Strauss, he was one of the other producers on it. I said to him, Aaron, I need to hand it off and not do any more editing. I need an editor to finish the editing, and reached out to you as well. Do you know any editors, Ron? Right, struggling here. And I didn't want to admit that, right? Because you know, you want to project strength. You don't want to be vulnerable or show weakness. You want, because there's this fear of, oh, people may not believe in me anymore. They may not support me anymore if I show that I'm making mistakes and I don't know what I'm doing all the time. But it was complete reverse. It was like, yeah, no problem. You got it, man. Yeah, there's a list of editors. Yeah, if we can get you, let's move.
Yeah.
So it was just like, okay, I don't need to do everything myself. In fact, it's probably best that most things I don't do. If I'm the driving force behind this, that's okay, but I don't have to do all the driving.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I figure to identify the things that I'm least proficient at. And in that case, it was ironically the editing, which I thought I was the best at, because I had edited so much. And so I got super overconfident. Right. And it really, in the couple scenes that were edited by a professional editor, in my opinion, are way light years beyond all the rest of the scenes that I had edited. Right. So I'm like, that's what a scene looks like. Right. Super, super self-critical about it, but, it's like, yeah, there's a flow here. There's reaction shots. There's like a timing with the music. It's like, man, I wonder what it would have looked like had the entire movie been edited not by me, right? And so there's this whole, there's can be this unhealthy spiral of regret. It's like, man, I should have done this.
Yeah,
I could have done that. I could have done this better. And but ultimately, the movie is what it is, and it became what it is now. And I am proud of it because it is so flawed. I'm proud of it because it is a journal entry.
Yeah.
Right. It is. Okay. Yeah. The next movie I make, I have learned from that journal entry, and I'm going to write another journal entry, and it's going to include more writers.
Yeah.
Right. It's going to include more people, and I'll do what I enjoy most, which is acting. That's actually what I enjoy most.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the directing, but it was super stressful because it's like every decision runs through me. And it's like, wait, hold on. I'm actually uncomfortable making all these micro decisions. I don't need to make all these, but I have to because it doesn't fall on anyone else.
Right. And oh, by the way, you got to get into the scene and you got to, you know, stay in the moment and react. And, you know, we're doing a stunt and you're, you know, it's all those things. certainly, you know, I definitely was cheering you on and rooting for you, but wanted to, you know, if there was anything that I could do, I was hoping to try to come alongside. People don't, yeah, I say this, that every film that finishes should just win an Oscar. They should just win an Oscar, you know, because people that don't do it, there's people that call themselves filmmakers. And one of the questions I ask, and I say this somewhat in jest and somewhat a little bit of truth, that you're not a filmmaker until you've done a feature film. You're not a filmmaker. You can't call yourself a filmmaker because it is so, it's such a different animal. It is grueling, you know, and it will fight you that every step of the way. I'll never forget on the Rangers, our very, very first day of filming, we had a scene, you know, in a schedule and everything all laid out. And we probably had, God, I don't know, it was a huge crew. And we probably had 40, 50 people there. We had orcs and makeup and people sitting around and prosthetics and all that. And it was a hot day. And we've got all those things together, people trying to work lines. And they had just met each other the day before. And we had two of our actresses that were flying from overseas get caught up at the airport and weren't able to make it. And we've been waiting on them for a few hours, unbeknownst to us, that they got caught up there. And so the day just kept rolling by and we hadn't rolled cameras. And I remember a few of the other producers came up to me and was just like, hey, maybe we should just call the day, you know, just call it. You know, we're getting, it's, things aren't going right and things. And I just remember saying, no, we cannot do that. That is an absolute non-negotiable. That's off the table. We have got to roll cameras today. We are going to shoot something. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being a very, one of my, you know, favorite shots. It's where, you know, the four Rangers are just creeping up and you're kind of on point. And it's when Wolf, Lieutenant Wolf, sees the orc tracks and you miss them, you know? And so mm-hmm. he kind of halts you, he halts the group up and he comes up and says orcs. And he's like, oh yeah. You know, and you're like, oh, I should have caught that type of thing. And it turned out great. But mm-hmm. had we gone with the kind of feeling of it and the momentum of things, we would have potentially very likely pulled the plug on that. And that just would have set the precedent for, you know, failure. And no film ever turns out exactly the way that you think it's going to be. It becomes its own animal, you know, mm-hmm. at the writing phase, at the shooting phase, and at the editing phase. And you're right. It they are what they are. And we do a disservice to all the people that are part of it if we don't put them out into the world. Because there's a fear factor and there's a part of me that doesn't want to put it out there because I know what people are going to say. Mm-hmm. And I owed it to everyone to put out there and birth this thing and say, you know, for good or bad, right or wrong, this is it. I've definitely learned from it and I'll do another thing. I'll do another journal entry a little differently. But here is what we came together in this moment in time. I mean, like mm-hmm. you said, dude, we were only going to do a 20-minute short, end up being, you know, 50 minutes and, you know, another version that's an hour. You know, you've been very open about your mental health journey. Mm-hmm. And I too have been on my own journey with mental health with, and unfortunately we also share this in common, but I lost my brother unexpectedly about a year and a half ago. And
oh, Ron, I didn't know that.
Yeah. My little brother, Travis, passed away from a heart attack very unexpectedly. Just seemed like he was fine. And then one day I talked to him on Friday and then I get a call on Sunday. He went to our family's cabin and then he unexpectedly passed away. He was actually on the Rangers and played the bartender in the yeah. Rangers. So
yeah, he did.
He passed away and I went down my own. I knew it would impact me, but it really zapped me. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons why I'm doing this podcast, quite honestly, because I had to pull myself up out of the darkness. I went lower than I thought I could ever go. And I kind of felt like I needed to get out of it. So I needed to do something for somebody else. And so that's what I needed to do to create. And so I put together this podcast. And one of the areas that I find interesting about filmmaking and creative is how does one find longevity in this industry or contentment? Because contentment is something I've pursued for a long time. And I don't know that I ever landed on it, but I'm trying to, you know?
When you say contentment, do you mean being satisfied with where you're at?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yes, exactly. Being at peace with where I'm at. Like I didn't move to LA. I had visions of that. I didn't go to Hollywood. I've never been backed by a big studio. You know, I've never, you know, these things that you're, and yet I don't want that to define my life. I want to find contentment right now with where I'm at with my wife and my beautiful kids and the life that I have now, I think many people, the American dream almost, is a false sense of being not content with where you're at. And it's created this crisis, I think, of mental health, particularly in the area of the arts. Because if you're not doing full time and getting paid full time money to do the arts, well, you're just a failure. You're not good enough. And I reject that wholeheartedly. I can go down to my local community theater and see some of the best actors I've ever seen in my life. And they're right here in my own community just because they decided to become a mom versus going to LA. Right. And I don't think that has to constitute failure. You know, I think that can constitute success, you know, and I'm trying to, but I have been on this journey, if I'm being vulnerable myself, of trying to create, because there was a moment where I thought for a second, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to be a filmmaker anymore. I'm not going to be a storyteller. And a part of me, I got to tell you, died within me. And I realized that was not an option. That I had to reject that. Like, that wasn't coming from a good place. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I asked that question with the heart of being sincerely wanting it answered on my own behalf, of creating this idea of longevity and contentment, because I want to make sure that I am content with where I'm at, not in the pursuit.
I think it's a very poignant question and very relevant to today. And I would say that for the only thing that I could really say about that is first prefacing, I guess, this with I know next to nothing when it comes to really pretty much everything. And all the things there are to know, I can only really speak to my own experience. And so I guess that's the thing that I'll share about that. And with myself, what's really helped me was accepting the past as a concept of reality, something that can't be revisited, but only in the mind. And accepting the future as endless possibilities, many of which are ridden with anxiety. And so the most practical place to land is in the present. And so for myself, by staying present, by keeping present in my mind, really helped me focus on whatever it was, the task at hand that I was doing. And it made it so I was actually able to feel that semblance of contentment, because that was the only thing that I had any sort of control over, was just, what am I doing right now, today, in this moment, in the eternal now? I'm talking to you, Ron, right now.
Yeah.
And that's exactly where I want to be. Because with time, which is the most precious resource and commodity there is, it's by approaching not just what I did for work, but really all aspects of my life, whether I'm spending time with my kids or I'm working on a project or traveling with my wife, whatever it is, this is exactly where I want to be right now. There's no other place I want to be, because I could be anywhere, really. My environment could take me many places, but if I just decide that this is where I want to be, then that sheds so much weight. That just, like, all right, I don't need checked bags. I'll just take a backpack on this plane, you know?
Yeah.
And I'll zip right through, and that'll be that. Cause ultimately, any sort of thoughts that I had about the past and wanting to change stuff, it's like, there's a lot of the present that I was missing.
Yeah.
I was in moments with people where I wasn't actually in those moments with them. I didn't remember them the same way they did. They're like, oh, Dave, don't you remember when this? And like, I have like no memory of it, because my mind was just elsewhere. I was elsewhere. So I think that would be it. That's what I would say. That, but knowing next to nothing, right? Like that's just my own experience.
Yeah, no, that's all we can speak from.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like that. I like being present. And what I like what you said specifically, and I think what you said is choosing to be present. Like even though your mind wanders off, it's capturing that thought and pulling it back into the present moment and say, no, wait a minute, I'm going to stay focused here. Because it's not always easy. You know, you've got all the
No.
litany of to-dos, and then you're like, oh geez, what about this? You know, and so it's pulling it back and making a conscious decision to say, no, I'm going to stay here in this moment with you, with us, with what's going on. And you've had some crazy cool opportunities. You've traveled all over, like you said, been a part of a couple films now, which has been cool. You get to go to conventions, but I know we're coming down on time. I'd be remiss, and I know we could probably talk about this for the next 2 hours. But how excited are you about Henry Cavill's 40K cinematic universe? Because I got excited. I kid you not, I was thinking, I wonder what Dave's thinking. I wonder what Dave's thinking. Because if anybody was going to get it, I know you would get it.
Okay, so to I guess to illustrate the one of the reasons why I feel it's so impactful is at the time that he announced that he was doing something, making an Amazon series that was Warhammer related, I happened to be on TikTok and I looked at the hashtag for Warhammer, right? And I saw whatever few hundred million view actual like relevancy
Yeah.
videos or whatever. And then I looked up Henry Cavill and his was in the billions. And so I was like, okay, so if he himself is bigger than Warhammer itself,
Yeah. Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that was just on TikTok, right? That's not everywhere else on the
Yeah.
planet, right? And every like country that's seen Superman, that's seen The Witcher and seen all the stuff that he's worked on, right? It's like this is a lot bigger than I think any of us can possibly realize in terms of the reach that Warhammer is going to have once the series is made and up. And so
Agreed.
that it just dawned on me that it's like, okay, as a nerd, as a tabletop gamer, as a it's just a dude who enjoys movies and who's a fan of Henry Cavill. Like I wasn't afraid to show my tears of joy about that. I made a video. I posted
Oh
a
yeah,
video.
it was great. I
Right. And
loved
I
it.
was like,
I was with you.
guys, it's gonna be raw.
Yeah.
But this is why this means so much to me.
Yeah.
Right. It's because it's just me, it normalizes the thing that I'm passionate about, right? And then people are like, oh yeah, I heard about that from Henry. Yeah, Warhammer, you do that, right? Yes, I do that,
Yeah.
right? Yes, I play tabletop games. Yes, I make videos about it. Yes, I make my own games. Yes, I do all this stuff, and that's what it is, and that's why it's so important to me,
Yeah.
right? So, yeah, I'm a bit excited about
Yeah.
it.
Well, I like you, I think Henry's the right guy. If anybody's been vocal about it, it's been him. I think he nailed it. I think Amazon has the deep pockets enough to where they can go there. So I'm super excited about it. I think with him helming it, and in what I also love that he said is he didn't just say a Warhammer film, he said a Warhammer universe. So,
Yes.
you know, there's IP there that we can go in a lot of different directions, a lot of different places, and it sounds like he wants to. So
Yeah. And just
exciting.
one more thing
Yeah.
to one point there that makes it even better in his specific case is because he's posted online that he likes Warhammer. He's
Yeah.
mentioned in interviews and stuff. And so us Warhammer fans, we see those things and we pick them out, we instantly recognize them, right? So people who don't know what he's talking about, they're like, oh, okay, this is whatever he's talking about. And he, there were things online about creative differences for The Witcher and him leaving it because it wasn't staying true to the IP.
Yeah.
As it relates to Warhammer, which has a vast intellectual property with over 500 novels, and there's just so much rich lore that's being
Yeah.
developed for 40 years. And this extends to any fan base that really falls in love with the stories of the IP, of the lore. And for him to have hold so much integrity over that very concept, such that he would leave or he would separate himself, I should say, a massive IP that is The
Yeah.
Witcher, that's how much it means to him. I can't
Yeah.
help but get it. emotional about it because we resonate so deeply with these stories, right? And so to know that someone who understands that, who's at the helm of it, who can present these stories in a way in which it does the story's justice is like, okay, even better.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I think Henry's going to nail it. I think Amazon with Amazon's backing is going to be awesome. I do think he is, if I can put myself in one of us, you know, he's amongst friends. He's one of us. I think that's also what you're resonating against. He's been very vocal about it and doesn't shy away from it. And I think he wants to stand true to the IP. What are you working on next? What's next for you? I know, you know, a big one that you've already mentioned, which I love and can't wait to see more of, is y'all's own Ravaged Star. But what's kind of next for you guys? What are you working on next? What's kind of the next big thing around the corner?
So aside from that one, which is a moving train, it's our, we have recently developed the Mini Wargaming Forge, which is our online store, which is significant for us because for the first 6 years of our 16 years we've been in business, we had an online store, which we had to shut down.
Yeah.
And so now the store is back. The Forge is up and running. And it's not just a store where we're selling stuff. We're creating our own products. We're making our own gaming aids. We have a farm of 3D printers where we're producing, or we're designing and producing our own products that we're selling directly to audience. And so just bringing this back really, really briefly to Mr. Beast and what he mentioned in a number of interviews where he said, you can promote other people's products or you can promote your own products.
Yep.
And when you promote your own products, you stand to make so much more because that's the power of marketing, the power of influence is you can really flex that muscle when you create your own thing. And you reap all of the you reap the benefit of all the effort that goes in it, and it's proven to be that in our case as well, which I'm not at all surprised by that because you know it's a scalable concept whether you're Mr. Beast size or you're just starting out. Actually, if you have a product already, if you have a course that you make, whatever it is. I would actually just bring it back to being a creator and starting a channel and monetizing it. That would be something that I would focus on as well as the channel itself. What are you offering? What is being offered in addition to your content? Right? Because if you do it, if you're making your own thing, then when you market it, it's so much more genuine because you genuinely care about its success. And you're going to be doing things creatively to present that in ways that are way different than, okay, here's a product that I'm signed to promote. I got to do it justice. And really what I want to do is actually just make the fun video. And I got to integrate this somehow creatively in it so that people don't skip over it, right? And so instead of thinking of it that way, the entire video could be an advertisement really for your product. And it's perfectly relevant. And the whole thing is a story. And the whole, like, it's just, you can do so much more with the storytelling process if you're promoting your own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. That's certainly some of the stuff that we've tried to do at Forge is not just create films, but to create stories and worlds within those. So IP is there. So we have card games and, you know, I've developed board games and a comic book, and I've gone into a bunch of different areas, novels now, and certainly films. Where can people find you? What's the best way to kind of track what Mini Wargaming Dave is doing?
There's Instagram, I would say Mini Wargamer Dave, Mini Wargaming on Instagram and YouTube as well. Go to the Mini Wargaming YouTube channel where you see, you'll see videos that I make. You'll see videos that the Mini Wargaming team makes. There's a bunch of us that make videos and show gameplay and just show what the industry is all about.
Yeah, that's awesome. I know, you know, when we met all those years ago at Gen Con, it took about 5 minutes where I felt like there was a unique connection between us, a bond that you don't get from everybody, you know? And I think you're one of those rare gems, Dave, that people, you have a gift that people resonate with that. And you're able to do that and go deep with many people. And I so love that about you. I love that you still reach out to me as a friend and as a fellow creator, and you see me through that lens. It's also very cool that you know, treat me as such, as an equal there. I love who you are, brother. I love what you're doing. I love supporting what you're doing. And if there's anything I can do, I definitely want to do it. I appreciate everybody listening and watching. And I believe we could go on and on for sure, but we're going to wind this down and we're going to go ahead and conclude this discussion with Dave. And we will see you on the next one. Thanks, Dave.
Cheers.